Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. It is March 16th, 2017. I am your host, Chris Martinson. Today, we are going to be talking with leading health nutrition expert and all-around great guy, Rob Wolf. He's got a new book out titled Wired to Eat, which follows his bestseller, The Paleo Solution, which helped hundreds of thousands of people lose weight following a low-carb diet. But the paleo eating regime, I'll call it a regime, not a diet, is really only a starting point, not a destination. And this is where Wired to Eat comes in. So if you are seeking to either get in better health or to understand why our so-called modern diet is actually a complete disaster for most people, then keep listening. It is my distinct pleasure to welcome Rob Wolf back to our program. Welcome, Rob.
Chris, thanks for having me on. And I just have to say thank you for all of your work. Peak Prosperity has really been a North Star for myself and my family the past, almost 10 years. So I cannot thank you enough for your work. And it's a huge honor to be on the show.
Oh, likewise. This is the Mutual Admiration Society, and we're having our inaugural meeting here because your work has been absolutely foundational. I am a transformed person myself, and together I think we're helping to transform the world in each in our own ways. So I'm really looking forward to this. I know you put a lot of work into this book, but the title, you and I, we're both biologists in our background, and you called it, I think we both had training in genetics, but you have this word wired. To me, that's intuitive. But for people who maybe didn't come through our same background, what do you mean by wired?
You know, the title is Wired to Eat. And what I try to do in this story, I think so much of why I have found your work appealing is the fundamentals that you deal with: energy, the economy, and the environment. And I'm not that bright of a guy, so I need simple stuff that, you know, big picture heuristics that give me a lot of information without a lot of CPU usage. And the other E that I might throw into that story is evolution. And people can get kind of weirded out about that if they don't like evolution, then maybe we call it nature. But I see these formative elements or trends that, you know, occur in nature. And when we understand our genetic predilections for certain things, then a lot of the challenges that we face are not that surprising. Like, we've had a tendency to moralize things like the desire to eat all the food and to sit on the couch and not exercise. And when you look at this from kind of a natural systems approach, this completely makes sense. Any organism on the planet, and it's so interesting because you're describing this process just with our fossil fuel usage, you always need to extract more energy out of your environment than what you're expending to get it, or you have problems like death or implosion. Mm-hmm. And if you can wrap your head around that, and it's kind of hard for folks to think about, because if you live in a westernized society, we've rarely gone hours without, you know, food or shelter or, you know, comfort. Whereas in the natural world, you know, any organism and humans, when they lived as hunter-gatherers in pre-westernized societies, if you had a meal today, there wasn't a guarantee that you had a meal tomorrow or the next day or the next day. And so there was a really hardwired tendency to eat as much as you could, save energy, and just kind of go about your business in that fashion. And this is called optimum foraging strategy. And any organism that moves to get nutrition, to get its calories, it follows this kind of thermodynamic economic process. But the implication there for today is that if you have those drives to eat more and move less, but we can work from our home, sit in our underwear, order food to our front door, pop it in a microwave, it comes in a huge variety of flavors and textures and palate options, then in a way you could argue that we have kind of won the lottery on the optimum foraging strategy. Like, we're burning virtually no calories personally, and we're getting an enormous amount of variety and quote, I'll put nutrition in somewhat air quotes, you know, definitely calories. And so we've kind of maxed that system out, but now we've gone so far that direction, our biology never really understood a condition of chronic plenty. Like there really isn't a process for effectively dealing with that. And that's what we're facing today. And so often the challenges that folks have when they're trying to make dietary and lifestyle changes, there's a huge sense of guilt and failure because they just can't figure out why this stuff is so darn difficult to deal with, but it's at that fundamental genetic wiring level. And so if folks can understand how they're wired to eat, which includes elements of sleep and photo period and community and stress and the gut microbiome, like there's a lot of factors that go into that. But if they understand that genetic wiring and how our neuroregulation of appetite works, then we can at least begin this process of decoupling from the current food system and things like hyper-addictive social media and whatnot. We can start that at a spot where we're not encumbered with guilt and this sense of moral failing, because decoupling from these things is difficult. And, you know, for some people, they navigate it in a pretty effortless way, but they are the exception, not the rule.
Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking of so wired is a pretty good metaphor. Like if I turn on a switch on the side of my wall, it's wired to a light bulb. And so that light bulb goes off. That's what happens. And if I can flick that switch all I want, but maybe my stereo isn't going to come on. Right. And so that wiring is essential. And I know that as humans, we like to think we have free will. But let's just be clear about this. As organisms, we're wired with certain predilections that are just sitting there. So like I love a freshly mown lawn of bright green grass in July. You know, it's a beautiful thing. It smells great, but I'm not wired to eat it. I've never actually had any urge to eat my lawn, right? A sheep wired differently would experience that totally differently, right?
Right.
That's what we mean by wiring, right? So we're wired for certain things. Like roadkill doesn't do a lot for me, but the buzzards think it's amazing, right?
Right, right.
All right.
You'll keep going. Keep going.
So we're wired in certain ways. And I know that because you begin your book Wired to Eat by telling us in a chapter titled It's Not Our Fault, which, if I have this right, makes the case that our biological roots have been and are being exploited rather mercilessly by food and marketing industries. Have I got that about right?
You've got it 100% right. And you know, it may sound a little bit tinfoil hat, but I might be among friends in that regard because of the stuff that you share with folks. But, you know, it's interesting to me and really educational. The folks who are involved in making the food producers that are really good at making these hyper palatable, super tasty foods. Like, what's the Lay's potato chip tagline? Do you remember that one? Bet you can't eat just one. I'll take that bet all day long. But these folks early on started really studying neurophysiology, evolutionary biology, addictive qualities of drugs and other behaviors. And they use that to engineer the food that we're consuming to make it repetitiously addictive. And similarly, when the social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter, they didn't know initially why these things were so sticky, but they knew that they were. And then they got in and again started looking at the neurophysiology, the feedback loops, the dopamine, you know, incentive pathways. And they really started honing this whole process to make these things addictive. And and I don't use the addictive term lightly, like it gets thrown around a lot, but I mean, these things are legitimately addictive. They create this reward, you know, reinforcement pathway in the brain that is very dopamine driven. The same, you know, pathways that drugs like caffeine and nicotine and cocaine exploit. But my point here is that the folks who are perhaps profiteering from our situation, the food producers, the social media moguls and whatnot, they understand this evolutionary biology, neurophysiology, genetic wiring story at a remarkably detailed level. Then we get out to the gatekeepers, our medical providers, healthcare practitioners, the general media and the government, and trying to even raise the question, hey, could this ancestral health model, could this genetic wiring even be a concern? There's huge drama around whether there's any relevance to that, but yet the people who are making money and really profiteering from our suffering, they understand this stuff at a really deep level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And by exploiting that, of course, they can sell more of their product. And these are perfectly rational things for somebody to do if they're tasked with driving sales up for Lay's potato chips this quarter, or coming out with the next great little bar in a foil wrapper that's going to really sell well. Of course, you're going to take advantage of whatever we know, because if you don't, your competitors certainly will. On the individual level, I get that. But when we back up and we look at the larger statistics, like I love this obesity map put out by the CDC. It shows all 50 mm-hmm. states. And if your state's colored blue, you have a BMI of, you know, less than X, and, you know, or a percentage of people who are below what's considered obese. And starting in the mid 90s, this chart starts to pink up a little bit. And then through that late 90s, early 2000s, it's just an explosion of red, the red meaning an explosion of obesity. It's a giant epidemiological disaster. You see it go off like a bomb. And instead of investigating that as a culture, what's happened is we do fat shaming instead, you know, which is
right.
Like, oh, well, you fat people, I guess you have no willpower. But you get back to this idea that it's not your fault. What are you really getting at there?
You know, if we don't, let's back up just a little bit. And sometimes this is helpful. Sometimes it kind of gets out in the weeds. But I love this concept of Moore's Law. You know, this mm-hmm. this notion that, you know, like microprocessors get faster and cheaper, and you know, there's this innovation. And you can see Moore's Law in a ton of different places. And it has so improved our understanding of biology and the natural world that we live in, where at one point to sequence a human genome, it was about $10 million. Now it's pennies. And we are just awash in information. There were more than 30,000 peer-reviewed articles with the topic type 2 diabetes published in 2013 that you can find on PubMed. We know more about the physiology, the pathology, the biochemistry of type 2 diabetes, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, neurodegenerative disease, you know, on and on and on. We know more and more and more about this stuff than we've ever known in history. But yet these things are increasing at exponential rates. So the question there for me, you know, our cell phones aren't going backwards. They're not getting worse. Like, we're not, you know, developing a rotary phone as the answer to the iPhone or the Android. We're moving forward. All that's improving. So we're using innovation and engineering and science to make, you know, things like these technological devices better. But our ability to intervene in an effective way for healthcare is absolutely failing. And it's a potentially crippling element to the U.S. and westernized economies. And like, you know, this isn't even getting into things like underfunded pensions and the stuff that you routinely talk about. But this is another potential existential threat. And you would think the fact that we know more about these topics, we could do something effective. But the main things that we're told are eat less, move more, and everything in moderation. Which just seems like some great, you know, Mark mm-hmm. Twain folk wisdom. Man, that just sounds great. But the eat less, move more story is in direct competition with our fundamental genetic wiring. It is a, if we buy into this kind of thermodynamic, economic kind of story of organisms living in the natural world, eat less, move more is in exact opposition to our fundamental wiring, the incentives that are woven into our genetics. And then this notion of everything in moderation, I have no idea what that means when you walk down the snack aisle of a supermarket. Like, do people have moderation when they have a slice of cheesecake and then some potato chips and then some nachos or some chili cheese nachos or ginger chili cheese nachos? I mean, the palate options and flavors are literally infinite. And that plays beautifully to our omnivorous tendency to eat as much as possible, get as much variety as possible, do as little as possible. So the main narrative that we get from the media and the medical establishment, eat less, move more, everything in moderation, completely ignores the reality of our fundamental genetic wiring. And clearly, even if that supposition, let's say that people don't want to buy into that, let's just look at it from an engineering standpoint. Is this working? Is the recommendations that are being made, are the pharmaceutical interventions doing anything to improve the general lot of folks? And the answer is a clear no.
And even with that no, we still find the fat shaming goes on. But where's our Kraft and Unilever shaming? Where do I find that in the Wall Street Journal?
It's funny. And, you know, if you dig back a little bit, you do a little bit of digging. Back in 2012, Unilever opened up a division. They put $50 million into it, studying evolutionary medicine. Ooh. was what the article was. Uh-huh. So I don't know how that's going to manifest. Like, are they going to put some hats on and try to figure out how we avert this titanic, you know, potential catastrophe? Or are they figuring out how to exploit these tendencies with you know, these hyper palatable foods and drug-like substances? It's unclear where that's going. But again, one of these mega wealthy, you know, global reach entities absolutely sees the value in looking at this from a natural systems perspective. And if you go into most dietetic departments around the world, the vast majority of healthcare providers, this notion of taking kind of a natural systems and evolutionary medicine approach to looking at this problem is not on their radar at all.
Yeah, the cynic in me says that they'll discover some important things and they'll make those available to wealthy people or to those who can afford them. Because really, in many respects, this you know, the feeding of the masses is really a little bit of a socioeconomic story, because I will tell you that, you know, my own personal preference to eat organic to help save the bumblebee and maybe have some benefits for myself. I do that mostly for the biosphere myself secondarily, but that's why I do it. It's expensive. Mm-hmm. So in this, you know, I'm sure you run across this a lot. Do people say, listen, I'd love to eat well, but it seems kind of pricey. And what's the response there?
Yeah, you know, and I've done a few pretty good breakdowns on that, where I will compare this type of eating pattern, you know, like kind of a junk food eating pattern versus a more whole food, but not necessarily organic, and then a whole food and organic eating pattern. And you can make a pretty credible argument. You know, let's say, you know, you're kind of a starving college student, or you're just getting your family going. I could make a pretty strong argument that so long as you stuck with largely whole unprocessed foods, fruits and vegetables, you know, meat and seafood, even if it's not grass-fed, even if it's not organic, there's some pretty good benefit to be had there, both ecologically and physiologically, versus eating a junk food-based diet. And then as people get their feet under them a little bit, then I think that this is a little bit of the, you know, the syntax that people who are maybe doing a little bit better financially, we do help to subsidize that organic and permaculture system. It is interesting, though, when you go to virtually any other place in the world besides the United States, maybe Europe. I mean, you see this even in Australia and New Zealand. Grain-finished meat is a premium, and you pay extra money for it because it's more resource-intensive. Mm-hmm. And that fact is only hidden in the United States because of the complexity and ubiquity of the farm subsidy system. So an apple and a Twinkie should probably be very differently priced than what they are. But again, this is kind of a funny thing. And it, we talked about this a bit before we started recording. All of this stuff kind of is an outgrowth of this fiat currency and the ability to just print money and kind of figure out whatever programs we want to do. And it was Richard Nixon back in the early 70s that he was really desperate for re-election. He wasn't doing so well in the polls. And he reached out to the farmers effectively via farm subsidies and really bought a lot of bandwidth from those folks. And we have kind of lived with that legacy ever since then. So the costs are kind of complex, but I again, on my website, I've done some breakdowns on this where it's not quite as expensive as what people think. And also, the hidden costs are kind of buried into our tax structure and subsidies. And so, again, an apple should probably be less expensive than a Twinkie, and by quite a lot when you look at all the energy and infrastructure that goes into making that Twinkie versus the apple.
and the cost, of course, to our long-term health. But let me talk about something more immediately. My own recent health journey began with cutting out inflammatory foods and healing a leaky gut. Those were my sort of diagnoses there with a functional medicine person I was working with. But the real key in that, I feel, was that I had a food sensitivity analysis. This is looking at circulating IgG antibodies. The presence of those antibodies says, hey, some of this food you're eating made it whole enough across your gut that your body said, let's fight this. And that had a low-level inflammatory response. But the key there was that sensitivity analysis I had was like a fingerprint, and that it revealed my unique responses, me, Chris, the Ascendity, to a host of foods and food groups. You speak of personalized nutrition in Wired to Eat. How important is this idea, do you think, to the average listener?
Oh, man, it's critical. And, you know, I really think that there's enormous value in this general kind of ancestral health template. You know, get appropriate amounts of sunlight on your person, sleep in accordance with the daylight cycle, get community, move, feed your gut microbiome, eat largely whole unprocessed foods. And that general starting point, I think, is very difficult to improve on if you just wanted like a very simple 30,000 foot level, you know, kind of elevator pitch deal. But then beyond that, the granularity gets really complex, and it really calls into question the notion that you can have any type of a one size fits all recommendation. There was some research that came out of the Weizmann Institute in Israel about 2 years ago, and they did a fascinating study. They put a continuous blood glucose monitor on 800 people, and this thing measures blood glucose once a minute, every minute for the duration of the study, which in this case was 3 weeks. And then they put these folks, and they also did a gut microbiome analysis on these people. They did a full genetic analysis on these folks. Then they just started feeding these people different meals. And it was crazy, the variation in the blood glucose response to various people. Some folks would eat rice and they would have a barely perceptible increase in their blood glucose level. And other people would eat rice and it would be near diabetic levels. And these folks were being fed equal amounts of carbohydrate. And there were really wacky situations where like a banana would make a person look almost diabetic, whereas a chocolate chip cookie, they had a barely perceptible blood glucose increase. And, you know, everybody's like, man, I sure hope I'm a cookie profile. But there's some kind of interesting caveats to that. But what was really interesting was that there was just massive variation from person to person. It kind of followed the glycemic index to some degree, but there were quite remarkable deviations from that process. And I'm glad you mentioned the food sensitivity story, because our blood sugar control isn't just predicated on how much carbohydrate we eat. If we eat what's called an immunogenic food, if it's a food that causes an immunogenic or an inflammatory response in our body, that causes a release of adrenaline and cortisol, and those chemicals ping the liver, and the liver releases glucose, because when we're under stress, and it doesn't matter if it's psychological stress, physical stress, or immunogenic stress, our blood sugars go up because it puts us in a fight or flight scenario. So people can eat some foods that may not have that high of an inherent carbohydrate content, but yet their blood glucose levels are really quite elevated for long periods of time. But that's being caused from a stress response and not specifically from the carbohydrate content of the food. And again, this stuff is all over the map. I've just been doing some experiments. I did a continuous blood glucose monitor and ate a wide variety of foods and tracked all that. Now my wife is doing this. And just kind of empirically, we've known that she's better at handling carbs than I am. Like, you know, we would eat the same meal and I would ask her, are you feeling okay? And she's like, yeah, I'm totally fine. And I literally would be drooling on myself, almost passed out under the table. And so we had some interesting things where, you know, both of us ate like a 50 gram aliquot of rice, white rice. And for me at 2 hours, my blood glucose was 186, which is darn near diabetic levels. And for my wife, it barely got above like 120. And She has a much healthier gut than I do. She's never had Giardia. She had fewer antibiotics in her past. Neither of her parents were type 2 diabetics. Both of my parents were. My mother was likely gestationally diabetic, so I might have some in utero factors. So when we get into the explanatory piece, that can get really complex. But the fundamental reality is if we test some of this stuff, both subjectively and objectively, the subjective measures, you know, how do you feel between meals? Do you have any foggy headedness from a particular food? What do your blood glucose numbers look like? Then we can get pretty granular on an individual level. But it's this is a real big challenge for me in talking to the greater nutrition world, because people love getting into quasi-religious camps. And if you suggest that some people may do well on high carb and some people may do well on low carb and some people may do well with legumes and other people not, whichever camp that really buys the particular thing that you may be saying another group may not do well with, like, they just freak out. They have no capacity to look on that other side of the fence and realize that other people may do fine on something that you individually do not do so well with. I do really, really well on a quite low carb, you know, oftentimes ketogenic diet, but not everybody does. And it was a long learning process for me to come to that reality. I had a long history of confirmation bias where I found people who were similar to myself. They would benefit from what I was doing, which was a low carb diet. And then I thought that I was a genius and I had all the answers. And then as I started working into larger and larger populations, I experienced people that this, you know, square peg, round hole kind of thing wasn't working. And I thought the problem was them, but the problem was me and my inability to expand my reality to encompass this notion that not everybody is the same.
And I am really intrigued by doing that carb testing just to get that data, because for me, it was really important to get my fingerprint of foods that I was at least allergically responding to on one level. That's one level of response, but you're talking about an entirely different set of responses, which is could be based on a whole host of factors, including my stress levels and this and that and all that, and maybe even stuff in utero, right? You don't know, hard to explain why, but the what of it's easy enough. You get yourself tested and you start getting some data and you discover, oh, white rice does this to me. That's part of my fingerprint at this point in time. And I've been following on your Instagram account, which is Das Rob Wolf. I assume D-A-S.
Yep, Rob, yep, with, yep, that's it. Yeah, little German twang.
Das,
yep,
Rob Wolf. Yeah. Rob, D-A-S, Rob with 2 B's, of course, Wolf. And you can follow Rob there on Instagram. And you've been putting your wife through a 7-day carb test. Does that include all of this testing we're talking about?
Yes, it does. Yeah. And it's been fascinating because, again, she just has across the board much better glycemic control than I do. And she's 30 pounds lighter than I am, less muscle mass. You know, there's a lot of arguments there just from a dilution standpoint that I should handle these carbohydrates better. But man, you know, if we had a UFC battle between her pancreas and mine, hers would beat me within the first 30 seconds of the fight, you know. And again, you can really go quite deep trying to explain the whys behind this. And maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong, you know, the early life history and whatnot. But the reality and the liberating element of this is, even though my wife kind of pulled the genetic lottery and epigenetic lottery, like maybe your gut is quite healthy, maybe she has good genetics for handling carbohydrates and whatnot, I got dealt kind of a short end of the gene pool hand. But so long as I figure out what foods allow my blood glucose levels to look like my wife's, I'm going to have an equally healthy metabolic profile. And that's really the liberating piece of this story is, you know, maybe you're not going to have as much latitude in what you can eat, but, you know, the amounts and varieties, but I'll figure out what, you know, part of the sandbox I can play in and what amount of it I can consume. And then I'm quite healthy. I'm lean. My blood lipids look great. I'm super productive. I'm at 45. I have a lot of different pans and different fires. I have two daughters who are under the age of 5, and I'm able to stay on top of all that with the way that I feed and water myself. But if I just tried to grab a one size fits all approach and didn't do a little bit of a deeper dive, it would be really easy for me to eat what would appear to be a very reasonable diet, you know, it would be similar to my wife's. But if I ate the carbohydrate level that my wife eats, I would be sick. I would probably be peridiabetic, heading towards diabetes. And for her, it's an absolute non-issue. It's where she does quite well.
Fascinating. Now, you know, as I think through this, you know, of course, editorially, of course, what should happen is people should be able to go, you know, into their doctor's office or their health clinic. And this would be the very first thing, like this would be the starting point of all conversation. We're going to do this, you know, we're going to get you a little fingerprinting going on here. We're going to figure out your glucose response and carbohydrate response. We're going to check this out here. Start here. You know, as you said, Pareto rule, 80-20, I bet you 80% of our difficulties, you know, can be very easily addressed there. And the rest, it gets a little more sophisticated. But we don't have access to that. Of course, my doctors still don't have time to talk to me about nutrition. You make a great point in this book later on where you said, great, if you've made it through these few chapters, you now know more than 90% of the healthcare professionals out there about nutrition, which is the starting point of it all. And it's just like what you are writing about, people should have more easy access to through the systems we have. What I write about should be in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, but they're not. So here we are, and the reason people are listening to you and I talk about this is because it's kind of up to us now to take care of ourselves in this scheme, because the systems have failed us and will continue to fail us because the interests of the keepers of the system are at cross purposes to our own personal interests. So if you're wondering why you have to listen to things like this, very common sense, scientifically based inquiry and advice on, you know, a fringe blog, as it were, it's because, unfortunately, that's the world we live in right now.
And you know, it's true whether we're talking, you know, financial management or blood glucose control. It's kind true. Of ironic. There's some self-similarity there.
Yeah, it really is. So, you know, the heart of your book here is a 30-day reset. Talk to us about that. What does that really mean?
Yeah. So the front part of the book really gets into the why, you know, why, how are we wired to eat? What are all the factors that govern that? And it relates to sleep and photoperiod, stress, gut microbiome. So I try to build a picture about how the neuroregulation of appetite is set up, you know, how the modern world is, it kind of stacked the cards against us. And now here's how we're going to decouple from this process. And so we begin a 30-day reset. And prior to that reset, I make a really strong case to do a triage process. And it starts with both subjective and objective elements. The subjective elements, again, are, you know, when you eat, how do you feel between meals? Do you get hungry? Are you clear-headed and super energetic? And that provides some really good feedback for us on a subjective level. And then we look at some objective measures like blood glucose levels over time, which is a test called a hemoglobin A1C, fasting blood glucose, some really simple things like a hip-to-waist measurement that gives us kind of a rough and ready sense of our insulin sensitivity. But that whole picture kind of gives us a story about where we are with regards to metabolic health. Mm-hmm. And then that will help us drop into this 30-day reset. And although not everybody in the world is insulin resistant and inflamed, a whole lot of people are. And so as they go through this process, they're going to notice that they probably end up on this more insulin resistant kind of inflamed side of the spectrum. And I provide some recommendations, which is kind of a anti-inflammatory, lowish carb diet. But the low is kind of relative. Like I give a spectrum between about 75 and 150 grams of carbs a day, which if you're eating the types of foods that we're recommending is actually pretty aggressive to get that much down. Like you will be challenged to eat that many. And we motor forward for 30 days with that at a minimum. And then we look back and just do something that is really, you know, a greasy used car salesman, non-transparent, which we just look back and say, how do I look? How do I feel? How do I perform? Is it better than what it was before? And is the effort worth the reward? I mean, it's about as transparent a process as I can conceive of. You know, it's like, is the work worth the effort? And so generally, folks, again, to your point, they'll reach kind of a Pareto 80-20 point where they will say, yeah, I feel a lot better. My cognition is a lot better. My joints don't ache, or, you know, whatever their individual issues are. From there, then, I recommend that people do a 7-day carb test where they use a simple, inexpensive glucometer and they track a battery of meals that are basically composed of carbohydrates. And we see what the mapping is, like where is the outer boundary of what your ideal blood glucose response is to things like white rice and lentils and things like that. I do make a pretty strong case in the book for most people to remain gluten-free. And that raises a lot of eyebrows. There's a lot of contention around that stuff. I guess my sales pitch on that is a little bit indirect, but I'm suggesting, and I'm trying to be successful selling books and like appearing credible and whatnot. And I'm suggesting that people remove a food group that is arguably one of the tastiest and most ubiquitous on the planet. And so if I could figure out a way to get people to eat refined grain products, particularly wheat, and still be healthy, that, you know, I would sell more books than Harry Potter. So the reason why I make that recommendation is I really see people benefit from that. My real background was in cancer and autoimmunity research, and that's what got me into this. And for good or ill, I've kind of become the poop guy, like the poop and digestion expert. And there are so many issues that end up improving dramatically with the removal of gluten containing items. So that's kind of a long diversion on that. But we use that 7-day carb test to, again, map what our experience is with various types of carbohydrates. And then we're able to take this information and then kind of ride off into the sunset. We have a pretty good sense now of what feeling good both feels and looks like. We have a good sense of, you know, what types of carbohydrates we do best with. If we have some carbohydrates we really, really like, but maybe we don't do spectacularly well with large amounts of it, maybe we have some mitigating strategies, like we do a hard workout and then, you know, consume some of these carbs. Maybe you have a little bit of vinegar with it because a high acid environment in the stomach tends to slow glycemic release and blunt the insulin response. So we do have some mitigating strategies. So, but until we test these things and we know where our boundaries are, we don't really know if it's a good idea or a bad idea to have a particular food or a particular amount of that food.
Well, I'll tell you, my weakness is potato chips, and I can't think of a good mitigating strategy. Maybe if I super glued them individually to my leg hairs, that might work. I don't know. Otherwise, I'd have to have them.
But you know, I'm pretty hairy, but I would pretty quickly denude my body of fur, and then it's kind of like it's on after that. So it's like I'll take that hit. I'll probably eat 50 to 60 potato chips that are hairy, and then from then on out, it's you know, full steam ahead.
I'll feel like a dolphin. It'll be amazing.
Right.
So. But very quickly, you've mentioned it twice, this glucose monitoring thing. You know, once upon a time, people had to stick their fingers and get blood out. What's the state of, when you say a glucose monitor, what kind of a device are we talking about these days?
Oh, man. Now, if we were in Europe, where we have some interesting
where there's freedom.
yeah, where there's certainly more innovation in the healthcare space. If we were in Europe, you could take this really slick wearable tattoo that's an RFID device, and you slap it on the back of your arm, and that thing will last 2 or 3 weeks. And you have a little scanner that you pop over it, you know, once every 8 to 9 hours, and it would upload your blood glucose levels that are checked once a minute. And it would be relatively cheap, and it would be comparatively easy to get, which is interesting. Europe's kind of squirrely in that regard with free access to some things. But in the United States, the continuous blood glucose monitors are pretty large, pretty clunky. There's kind of a monopoly in the current system. So it's all insurance driven. So it's about $1,500 to get these things. Doctors generally won't prescribe them unless you are already diabetic. Like if you just go in and say, hey, I want to get a CGM, a continuous glucose monitor, and your doctor's like, well, you're not diabetic, you can't have one. And there's really no reason why, other than this is just kind of the convention. And so for most people, they're kind of left with going to their Walgreens or CVS and getting a $10 to $20 blood glucose monitor that involves the lancets and the finger strips and all that type of stuff. But it, you know, probably 5 years from now, these wearable transdermal monitors are going to be ubiquitous. The Apple Watch is theoretically able to do a pretty good job monitoring blood glucose levels. Some people know how to jailbreak for that, and they can integrate it with some of these other platforms to be able to get some readings. Some of the holdup on that is Apple wants the Apple Watch to be medical device quality, and so they're kind of waiting on that process. But at some point, we're going to have some really easy measurements that don't involve a finger stick. And I do have to say, like, I really dislike needles, but these lancets are tiny. They're smaller than a human hair, and they literally don't hurt. But even still, I will admit that my heart rate probably skips up about 40 beats a minute extra when I get ready to do it. So I am kind of a coward in that regard. So I understand if folks aren't that fired up about that.
Yeah. Now, so talk to us about some of the results that are coming in from your work here with this, with the reset, with people beginning to follow this, with the customization, personalization starting to come. What are you starting to see here? What can people look forward to if they follow this path?
Oh, you know, so one of the first things that is really interesting is there is a lot of variation from person to person. So I have a really good friend, Eva Twardokin. She's a 2-time Olympian, 6-time giant slalom world champion, really an amazing athlete. And it was fascinating. Like, for her, white rice and white potatoes were good to go. But lentils, which I would be hard pressed to really even find much carbohydrate in lentils. Uh-huh. It's mainly protein and fiber. I mean, they're a very low glycemic load food. But for Eva, the lentils produced a near diabetic blood glucose level, and it went on for like 4 hours. Like, she just couldn't pull things back down. Huh. Whereas white rice and white potatoes, she cleared everything. Everything was good. Her cognition was great. So we've had a lot of interesting results like that, where, you know, some foods that you would otherwise think that wouldn't be a problem were problems for some folks. But generally what we see, if people are getting their blood glucose levels right, and I provide some recommendations in the book that are quite a bit more aggressive in control than what the standard of care is. I actually want to fully avoid the potential of type 2 diabetes, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, which all these things are now pretty well understood to have an underlying factor of poor blood glucose control, hyperinsulinemia, and stuff like that. So I set these benchmarks pretty tight because I actually want to avoid these entirely, not just kind of slightly mitigate my risk. But what we're finding is if folks really get their glycemic control right, they spontaneously reduce caloric intake. They just feel good. They are satiated. They ate a meal and they're like, man, I could go 6, 8, 10 hours without eating. And they may get hungry, but it's not a crippling, debilitating sense of hunger, you know, mm-hmm. like they would have if they're experiencing these really high peaks and troughs in blood glucose. When people start spontaneously reducing caloric intake to a level that is amenable to just maintenance, they tend to lean out, they lose lots of body fat, their blood pressure drops, their glucose numbers improve, cognition typically improves, inflammation reduces, physical performance, you know, goes up. So the results are all, you know, pretty remarkable, and it's very consistent in the you know, if you get the numbers right for you, then you kind of get these outputs, but it's inconsistent in that what may work for me may not work for you, and it's going to be, and, you know, I'll about guarantee you my wife is going to beat the pants off of both you and I. So it's, you know, so there's variability in that regard. So you really can't look across the table or the work environment and see what someone else is doing and really let that inform you too much. It's really needs to be kind of a personal exploration.
All right. And that fits with my own personal inquiry into all of this. So this feels right. This feels like the direction we need to go. At the root of it, though, can we just be clear that the food industry in this country is pumping out stuff that's really actually not food? In the sense that it's going to, you know, sustain us and provide nutrition and lead. Here's the thing, Rob, here's what I think is wrong. I think that the way it's sold to us, and I think it's true given the environment we've created for ourselves, is that health is something you achieve, right? You got to work for it, right? So I'm here, I want to be healthy. So it's a climb up. I'm going to have to do stuff. I'm going to have to give up things and work. I'm going to have to eat less and move more, right? So health is something I achieve, but as soon as I relax for a minute, I fall back down, right? I think that's upside down. I think health mm-hmm. is something that should be the baseline, and that we should view anything off of that baseline as an accidental fall into a pit, right? That we shouldn't be in, right? So really, I think it's inverted, the whole structure. Like health, my body is right now co-living with, I don't know, 100 trillion other things, and we're all making out fine. And I get cancer every day, I hear, and my body clears it out. And it's astonishing that my body knows self from other and can take this complex stuff that I put into this, you know, tube that goes through me and extract what it needs. It's an amazing process. And I think health is actually the baseline, but it's not if you're throwing bad fuel into the furnace.
Yeah, yeah. And again, to your point, all of the incentives, all of the structures are aligned against achieving that health, because it's so similar to what you talk about with financial resiliency and having solid community, you know, the different types of capital that one may have. If you really make a decision to optimize your capital, and you talk about health as a primary capital, but what you end up being is an individual that is largely decoupled from everybody that is essentially grifting, you know, extracting some value out of your suffering. You know, it's like, hey man, you deserve that new car, you deserve that whole cheesecake, you know. And it's like, well, I don't know if deserve is the right term, but it certainly caters to my ego, it caters to my impulse for novelty, and it becomes a you know, an entrapping kind of process. And so you know, it's fascinating to me, and I don't know if it's confirmation bias, but it's interesting to me the synergies between this food and health story and everything that you talk about in energy, the economy, and the environment.
Yes, well, it's absolutely a fascinating time to be alive. It is, you know what, it is editorially, here I go again. I think it's unfortunate that we have to put this much effort into thinking about our food, but we do, because this is the world we live in. You know, maybe we know things now that our forebears didn't know 200 years ago. So we do know, you know, people got gout and all kinds of metabolic diseases back then too. So the good news in this is that, yes, we know that we've got some things, obviously, epidemiologically, clearly we've been harming ourselves, and we know how to fix this, right? So that's what I love. You've got a roadmap here in the book. Two other things I should point out, the back third is recipes, a lot of recipes in here for weight loss and beyond. And then my favorite thing, you have a shopping list in the appendix, because that makes it simple for me. I'm a guy.
And we have a ton of support material at wiredtoeat.com or robwolf.com. And so you can download all those shopping and food guides and really try to make it as easy as possible for folks to navigate this whole change.
Well, fantastic. We've been talking with Rob Wolf, author of the new book just out, Wired to Eat. Rob, we can find that on Amazon, I assume. Where else?
Anywhere books are sold. Yeah. And even Costco's and whatnot. So it should be just about everywhere.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for writing it. Thank you for your time today. And we'll follow up, I'm sure, as the year goes on.
Thanks, Chris. And thank you again for all the amazing work that you and Peak Prosperity do.
You're most welcome. Thank you for that.